Monitor now invites you to Meet the Press, America's press conference of the year, winner of every major award in its field, a public affairs presentation of NBC News. Today's guest will be the surgeon who headed the medical team which implanted a heart pump in a human patient, Dr. Michael E. DeBakey. We will bring you today's program in a moment. The Federal Bar Association reminds us that freedom depends on the rule of law. The law protects you. Respect it. And here to help promote respect for the law and for those who enforce it is Secretary of the Treasury Henry H. Fowler.
Ours is a government of laws and not of men. Our steadfast adherence to this principle underlies the fact that the United States is today the oldest continuously democratic republic in the world. Maintenance of our form of government is dependent upon continued high degree of voluntary compliance with the laws passed for our common good by our freely chosen representatives, federal, state, and local. Our respect for law and the due process of law is unique among nations. But as our population grows and our life becomes increasingly more complex, we must become ever more vigilant in protecting our democratic processes. The laws we have are for our own benefit, advancement, and safety. I urge your continued healthy respect for our laws.
You have just heard pre-recorded the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry H. Fowler, speaking in behalf of the Federal Bar Association in support of its law observance program. Now meet the press. Today's guest is Dr. Michael E. DeBakey. Our panel consists of Alton Blakesley of the Associated Press, Harold Schmeck of the New York Times, Robert Abernathy of NBC News, Lawrence E. Spivak, producer and permanent panelist. Our moderator is Neil Boggs of NBC News.
We'll have the first questions now from Lawrence E. Spivak, permanent member of the Meet the Press panel.
Dr. DeBakey, the object of your heart booster implant was to prolong the patient's life. Since the patient died, why do you say that the operation was a success?
Well, Mr. Spivak, the operation was a success on the basis of fact that the pump did the job we wanted it to do in terms of providing adequate circulation for the patient and replacing the function of the left ventricle. The patient's death was due to causes beyond our control and would have caused his death had the pump not been used.
Well, now, was the lung failure, I understand his death was due to a lung failure. Was his lung failure in no way related to the heart problem?
Well, we don't believe that it was in any way related to the use of the pump. This precipitated his death through a rupture of the lung caused by both the lung disease which he had, which required the necessity for using positive pressure ventilation.
Well, now, could his life have been prolonged with a better heart pump?
No, his life could not have been prolonged with a better heart pump.
Now, you've been quoted as saying that you gained considerable knowledge from the implant of your heart booster. What would you say was the most important thing you learned?
Well, I think the most important thing we learned, Mr. Spivak, was the fact that this pump had proved successful in our experimental work. And we had reached the point where we had determined that it would do the job that we wanted to do, which was to take over the function of the left side of the heart, the left ventricle, which is the essential pumping function of the heart to pump blood and provide circulation throughout the body. Now, what we learned in this case, and I think the most important thing, is the fact that the pump will do this, taking over as much as 80% of the function of the left ventricle, and at the same time do it without any destruction or damage to the blood, which of course is absolutely essential to any pump. Now, up until this point, we had no evidence that this could be done in a human being.
Can you tell us how soon you plan to use the pump again?
Well, just as soon as the modifications that we are making in the design of the attachments of the pump, this is another thing that we learned, that we could make some modifications which would improve and facilitate its attachment.
Can you give us any idea how soon a satisfactory pump will be available for everyone who needs one?
Well, this question that must be modified to some extent in this regard. When you say for everyone that needs one, then it's essential to know what you mean by that. You see, this pump is not a permanent replacement of the heart. It's a temporary support for the heart, and by temporary I mean for periods of days, weeks, or even months if necessary, to provide the heart with a period during which it can recover. That is, to take the workload off the heart so that the circulation can be maintained, and in that sense, so that the individual can be kept alive by this means, during which the heart recovers from its injury or disease and then is able to take over again.
Well, now, I'm sure that there are a great many people throughout the country who have heart problems and who think that they can be helped by a pump of this kind. Now, how soon do you think a pump like the one you built is going to be more widely used?
Well, I would hope within this coming year the type of pump that we have developed and that has proved to our satisfaction successful in doing the job we wanted to do, that is, for this specific purpose, would be available to all medical centers and that they would be able to use it. I would say that in any medical center that is now doing, let's say, open-heart surgery, they would be capable of doing exactly what we did with this pump.
We'll continue the questions now with Mr. Blakesley.
Dr. DeBakey, heart surgery must involve tremendous human drama. Exactly what do you tell a patient before he is heading into an experimental procedure? And do you personally feel different emotions when you are taking a step of this nature rather than being in a routine operation?
Yes, well, I think it's important to distinguish between the ordinary operation that you advise or recommend to a patient and an operation in which you're going to apply an entirely new procedure. And so I, in talking with this patient, sat down and explained to him both the conditions under which we would be working, the gravity of the procedure itself, and the fact that we would like to attempt to support his heart with this new development. I explained to him that we felt quite confident about it on the basis of our experimental work, and that I thought that it would be of additional value in reducing the risk of the operation. He, of course, recognized himself the seriousness of his condition and knew that he had been deteriorating very rapidly. But we discussed it for some time, and I wanted to be sure he understood the conditions and the circumstances and my recommendation. And it pleased me to know that, at least to reassured me, that he did understand this and that he was eager to accept it. He didn't accept it with any hesitancy. He was seeking a way to get well.
Dr. Howard Rusk has referred to you as a man who cuts around the fringes of the soul. Do you have any estimation that this is involved in your heart surgery?
Well, one can easily get involved in philosophical discussions of this kind. I must resort in answering that question to the position that I feel I'm in, and that is, as a physician, I must try and do my best to provide a patient with whatever knowledge and the best knowledge in getting him well and relieving his suffering. And then in that sense, it seems to me, the patient must decide whether he's to accept it.
Mr. Schmeck.
Dr. DeBakey, there are two particular dilemmas that I think might have attended your recent attempt and certainly might attend similar attempts in the future. One of these is the possibility that you could finally bring the patient back to consciousness, but discover that you could not turn off the pump without having him die. And you would, in that case, be faced with the circumstance in which you had to keep him tied to the machine indefinitely to preserve his life. The converse of that, is the possibility that you could have given his heart enough rest so that this would recover, but that his consciousness would not come back, perhaps because of brain damage that happened previously. What do you think of these two dilemmas as handicaps to this kind of work in the future?
Well, in regard to the first one, we have given this matter consideration, and we believe that with the pump that we've now developed and the way we're using it, that it would be possible to prolong its use over an indefinite period of time, even though we are not sure of the, materials that we're using having the ability to take that stress over a long period of time and break down. Because the pump is so designed that we can actually replace the pump outside the body. Secondly, so far as the power for the pump is concerned, we're in a position now to be able to apply a power package which can be attached to the patient so that he becomes quite mobile and can move around, and if he's well enough, can get out with this power package. So that we feel that in this sense, we have at least a reasonably satisfactory answer to that dilemma. Mm-hmm. Now, in regard to the second dilemma, it is true that the pump would provide circulation, but if all the other organs of the body failed, then the pump would not be able to maintain viability of the organism. And there are sufficient criteria and parameters that are precise enough to determine this and to, in that sense, determine if death has taken place.
Mm-hmm. To pursue the second part of it just a bit more, I have heard that in a small but substantial percentage of heart-lung operations in which the patient's circulation and lungs are bypassed for a time, the patient ends up with a modest amount of neurological deficit. There is some damage to the brain. In the case of an artificial booster pump such as yours, if it were used quite widely by surgeons all over the country, as it would be expected to be,
yes,
some of them perhaps not as well trained in its use as your team is, isn't there the possibility that you would be increasing the number of such persons who live through their heart attack but turn out to be, say, slightly less intelligent than they were before?
Well, one must accept that risk, that possibility. My own feeling is it's a small percentage. Even today, with the heart-lung machine, we have continuously reduced the risk of neurological damage, so that it constitutes a very small percentage today in most medical centers, and an increasingly smaller one. Now, this risk must be judged in relation to the risk that exists if this pump is not used, the risk to death, so that I think one balances one risk against the other and determines by judgment whether he's justified in accepting one risk against the other. And this is done in all of surgery, in fact, for all of medicine. This is what we call clinical judgment, the determination whether or not the method you use provides a greater hazard than the natural course of events.
Mr. Abernathy.
Dr. DeBakey, pursuing a matter that Mr. Schmeck raised, if Mr. DeRutter had remained in a coma, and if the pump had continued to work, and if it were the pump that were in fact keeping him alive, but he was still in a coma with every indication that he would remain so, would the time have come when you would have been faced with the decision and would have made the decision to turn the pump off?
Well, as I indicated earlier, Mr. Abernathy, one answer to this would be determined by, as I say, certain criteria of viability of organisms. There are parameters that we can use, monitoring techniques for, say, brain function.
For instance, if there are no more brain waves?
Yes, that's right. If the kidney is not functioning well, the liver is not functioning well, and progressively functioning less well until there is irreversible damage taking place, then in general I would say that there would be a deterioration of all of the of the viability of all the organisms, and there would be no difficulty in determining that death now has taken place and the changes are irreversible. It would then be very difficult to maintain normal circulation, even with the pump.
With the prospect of the development of true artificial organs, do you think that there's a need to redefine what death is legally, and other ways?
Well, I think in the judgment of the physician, this is usually defined reasonably well. Now, it may well be that in the future we may have situations develop in which it becomes necessary to redefine it in a more precise way. But at the moment, I think that we have means of defining it reasonably well. And so I would have to say to you that it would be necessary to gain more experience with this type of activity before we would be in a position to say there is a need to redefine it more.
Mr. Spivak.
Dr. DeBakey, in January of this year, I believe you said that we could have a practical artificial heart model in another 3 to 5 years.
Yes.
What's your timetable now after your most recent experiment?
Well, I would say that, again, I don't want to hedge on this, but I must qualify it in this regard. This depends in large measure upon the effort that we make. If we made the ultimate effort and in a sense provided all the funds that need to be provided for the necessary research in this area, I believe that we still can have it within 3 to 5 years.
Now, as I understand it, the research and development for your heart pump cost about $4.5 million. Do you see the time when an artificial heart could be manufactured in quantity at a low cost?
Oh, yes. The cost of the pump itself and making the pump should be a reasonable amount. I would say that one could duplicate the pump that we made for perhaps just a few $1,000s. The research that went into this hasn't actually cost $4.5 million. The research program that is underwritten costs approximately that over a period of 3 to 5 years.
And once you've perfected the instrument, though, or the device, will you be able to manufacture it at a very low cost?
Yes. Yes, it shouldn't cost
hundreds of dollars or less than that.
Well, I think it would cost more than a few hundred dollars. I would say that on the basis at least of the type of pump we now have, that a few $1,000s anyway.
Now, when you speak of an artificial heart, do you mean a device ultimately that will completely replace the human heart and be as convenient and as satisfactory as the human heart? Or
well,
will it have many limitations?
I would say that at the present time, on the basis of our present knowledge, that we may have a heart that is satisfactory for the purpose of maintaining life in a reasonable way, but whether or not it'll be as efficient as the human heart, the normal heart, which is a very efficient pump, I think one would have to say that this would depend upon future developments.
Well, now, do you think if you ever do succeed in manufacturing an artificial heart that you'll be able to prolong life for a fairly long period of time?
Yes, I do.
50 years, 100 years?
Possibly. There are, Ms. Spivak, there's still a fairly large segment, an appreciable segment, of children who are born with defects in their heart that we can't correct. The mechanical aspects of the defect is of a type that is just not correctable by any mechanical means surgically. Well, under these circumstances, the only possible solution is a replacement of that heart.
Well, now, if the heart could keep going, say, for another 100 years, what about the rest of our organs? Do you think they'll last?
Well, I would hope, you see, that research in these other areas will provide ways and means for us to solve the problems that produce diseases of these other organs. And under the in that sense, yes.
Mr. Blakesley.
About 4 weeks ago, at a dinner in your honor in New York, Dr. Paul Dudley White spoke of your work and that of other cardiovascular surgeons and said, we aim to get rid of them eventually. We aim to make their work unnecessary through research to learn how to prevent heart attacks, heart diseases. What do you as a surgeon think about your prospects of becoming unemployed?
Well, I hope so. I'm very anxious to see the day when we won't have to do any kind of heart surgery. If we can solve the major cause of heart disease, which of course is arteriosclerosis and atherosclerosis, and I think we will solve it. I think it's just a matter of research. The knowledge to be gained from research will ultimately give us the solutions to the cause and the prevention. We are gaining in this. More and more intensive research is going on. This is why we need to intensify our research efforts. In this sense, this is the ultimate solution to the problem of disease, as it has been for so many diseases that we've solved and eradicated. It's come through research knowledge. One can cite any number of examples. Just in recent years, poliomyelitis is a beautiful example of how research solved the problem and virtually eradicated it. And we can do this with heart disease, too. And I think that we must put into this effort more activity, more support, because this is our greatest problem. It constitutes more than half of all deaths in this country. It costs our economy well over $40 billion a year. And when you think that the amount of research effort we're putting into this is a very small fraction, perhaps 1/4 of 1% of our total gross national product, you get some idea of the need for it.
Mr. Schmeck.
Before we get to the stage of having you unemployed, Dr. DeBakey, it seems to me there might be an interim period in which there aren't enough surgeons to go around. I've heard the estimate that perhaps some 400,000 Americans each year might be candidates for either a temporary or a permanent booster heart, if one were available. Are there enough surgeons to do this foreseeably in the next few years, and what would this do to hospital facilities if you had to put this many people in the hospital for this kind of treatment?
Well, of course, we need more facilities, we need more hospital beds, we need more physicians, we need more highly trained specialists. All these are needs that exist today, whether or not we had an artificial heart pump. This need is increasing. And so here again, you see, we must step up our efforts in the training programs and bringing more people into the health field that can be trained for these specialized jobs. And I'm not only talking about physicians, because we need people trained in many other disciplines that must be brought into the health field. With the expansion of science, with the increase in knowledge from basic sciences, I'm speaking of science in general, medical science expands because it gains its knowledge for scientific research efforts from all of science. So as we developed atomic science, we developed atomic medical science. It illustrates how these other disciplines must be brought in to help medicine.
Gentlemen, we have only a little more than 1 minute remaining. Mr. Abernathy.
Dr. DeBakey, how will you and other surgeons make the decision as to who will get an artificial booster or an artificial heart when they're in short supply?
Well, at the present moment, this decision is restricted to those patients whom, in our judgment and on the basis of our past experience, have a very high risk associated with any corrective surgery, and in whom the possibility of reducing that risk exists if we could temporarily support the heart.
Dr. DeBakey, From your long experience with the heart, what's your conclusion about cigarette smoking as it relates to heart ailments?
Well, I think it has a detrimental effect upon all forms of heart disease in a very, both a specific and a general way, in the sense that it produces a definite spasm of arteries, a reduction in circulation. And it's very, I think it's definitely detrimental.
I'm very sorry to interrupt Dr. DeBakey, but our time is up. Thank you, Doctor, for being with us today on Meet the Press.
This is Frank Blair. I'll be your host on Monitor beginning about 10 minutes from now. Auto safety and what the government should do about it is a vital question. In the Senate hearings, one of those who criticized the automobile industry was lawyer Joseph Kellner.
The modern automobile is not safe. It is not designed with a view to making it stand up in the event of an impact. I said our experience is that they must enact mandatory safety standards into these cars at long last to protect the public.
One who defended the industry, Ford Vice President John Bugis.
This industry has done, actually, an outstanding job. This doesn't mean we have done everything that we could have. And this doesn't mean that we should not now accelerate and speed up the process. We have done that, and we are doing it. But the job that this industry has done has been truly an outstanding one.
We'll hear both sides of the question and a possible answer. Even during war, songs are sung. One of the most popular among the people of South Vietnam is this.
Ôi em yêu kiều, ôi em yêu kiều, người yêu dấu, ôi Clementine. Em đã buồn núi, em đã qua đời, buồn gươm ghê rồi, Clementine.
Vietnamese folk singer Pham Duy. You'll hear how he met and performed with the American singing team of Addison Crowfoot if you join me, Frank Blair, for Sunday Evening Monitor, a few minutes from now.
For a printed copy of today's Meet the Press interview, send 10 cents in coin and a stamped self-addressed envelope to Merkle Press, M-E-R-K-L-E, Merkle Press, Box 2111, Washington, D.C. Do you realize 6.5 seconds could save your life or prevent serious injury to you and your family? 6.5 seconds. That's all the time it takes to pick up a seatbelt and fasten it. If everyone riding in an automobile performed this simple action, the National Safety Council says at least 5,000 lives could be saved each year, and serious injuries reduced by 1/3. Let seatbelts protect you with a margin of safety. Say your car stops suddenly in a collision or emergency, and you're flung forward with tremendous force. What stops you? Too often the dash, the windshield, or the steering wheel. Wearing a seatbelt, you stay put, protected by a margin of safety from serious injury, even death. So here's a reminder for you and your passengers the next time you drive. Enjoy the peace of mind and the actual life-saving benefits only seatbelts can provide. Take 6.5 seconds. Buckle your seatbelt. This might be the best investment in time you will ever make. Meet the Press will be heard again next week at this same time.
Hello, this is Bill Cullen. I'll be with you each weekday with my emphasis time off on NBC Radio. ¶¶